This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Michael Remus. Remo, good to see you.
Drew, nice to see you. Happy to be here. It's kind of a feel like there's not as many people here as there normally is.
Yeah, we're a little bit shorthanded today, but that's okay. We'll try and do our the best we can, even though we're playing without the usual team, shorthanded as it were.
We're kind of like the Winnipeg Jets usually are.
Hopefully, our shorthanded performance is better tonight than the Jets was last night in Pittsburgh, where too late Pittsburgh Penguins shorthanded goals, power play goals. The Jets were shorthanded. The tying goal and then the game-winning goal on the Jets while the Jets were serving penalties proves to be the difference last night in a 5-3 Pittsburgh Penguins victory over the Winnipeg Jets last night in Pittsburgh. And of course, we will start there when we look at last night's contest. Good to see that the NHL is back from the All-Star break. It's amazing how much you miss the NHL when it goes away for like 5 days.
Man, that was a brutal sports weekend. I mean, Sunday was the All-Star game and the Pro Bowl. I wasn't watching any NBA. I really missed my hockey on Saturday. I mean, I'll say this. The skills competition is nice, but it doesn't replace a full slate of games.
I don't even think that the skills competition is nice in my books. I'm proud to say that I didn't see a weekend this weekend of All-Star Weekend. I just have no interest. I know people would say, it's part of my job to watch or whatever.
Yeah, it's part of your job, Drew.
I disagree. Part of my job is to watch hockey. My job is not to watch a bunch of guys who don't really want to be there and don't care to be there skate around in a poor excuse for the game of hockey. And that's what the All-Star Weekend was. I just have no interest in it, but that's okay. I understand that it's probably for the people of Columbus, it's exciting, or for the yes. hometown team, it's exciting. And for the kids who are in attendance and get to see all their favorites in one spot in a rare extravaganza, it's exciting.
I'll say this, Drew. Going by what I've seen from the TV ratings from the All-Star game, most people would agree with you.
Yeah, most people would agree. I mean, the Pro Bowl also on Sunday didn't see a second of that, so I'm an equal opportunity disliker, which isn't a word, but you understand what I'm saying.
Right, of All-Star games.
Yeah, of All-Star games. Let's start with the Jets and the Penguins last night, and it was a game that the Winnipeg Jets probably looked at on the schedule before the season starts and said, into Pittsburgh right after the All-Star game, that's going to be a tough game. That's probably not a game that we expect to get a win at.
Yeah, historically, the Jets have not, the Winnipeg-Atlanta franchise have not been very good in Pittsburgh.
Right.
They're a Stanley Cup contender. They've got a number of big stars, Crosby, Malkin. But this game was a bit different than any other game against the Pittsburgh Penguins.
That's right. Without Crosby, without Malkin, all of a sudden, hey, this is a game for the taking.
Right.
This is a game where, we're playing well, obviously, because they were so successful before the All-Star break and, firmly in a playoff spot at this point in time. No Crosby, no Malkin, a weakened opponent. We can take advantage of this Pittsburgh Penguins team. What we saw last night, in my mind, was a Winnipeg Jets team that was flat and they were uncharacteristically sloppy. They were flat really only for the first period. After the first 20 minutes, I thought they got their legs underneath them and they were able to skate. And obviously, that bore itself out by taking a 2-1 lead at a point in the second period. But the sloppiness that we saw from the Jets, the lack of attention to detail, was uncharacteristic of what we had seen from this team up to that point in the season.
I would agree with you. I think the first period, they seemed to take a bit to get their legs. Passes that should have been tape to tape weren't going on the tape. They weren't making smart decisions with the puck. But if you look at the game as a whole, the one thing that really stands out to me is, I do enjoy looking at the advanced stats. I don't put all the weight into them. But if you look at the numbers like Corsi, how many shots, shot attempts you're on the ice for compared to against, the Lad Little Wheel line was absolutely terrible. And this is normally their top line, normally a very good defensive line. But they allowed twice as many shots, just about, as they as they took, shot attempts, twice as many shot attempts on their net compared to the ones that they took. And I thought that was really interesting, especially considering they were missing their top two players. And
the Penguins were missing their top two players.
The Penguins were. And the first line and the second line as well, not as much, but the first line really struggled. But the third line for the Jets really shone in the second and third period.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the performance of Evander Kane and Chris Thorburn and Adam Lowry as we go through looking back at last night's game. But you're right, the top two lines for the Jets were, I don't want to say that they were still on the All-Star break, because they weren't. There was a bad game for them, and it happens. You're not going to get the same level of performance through all 82 games in the course of a season. And you saw that last night, that was a bad outing for the top six of the Winnipeg Jets last night. It was also a bad outing for Andre Pavlik. And I know that Andre Pavlik is a whipping boy for everything that goes wrong with the Winnipeg Jets. Rightly or wrongly, I tend to think that he's unfairly blamed more often than not. But last night, he was not very sharp, much like the whole team. So it was a whole team phenomenon in that they were a little bit sloppy and a little bit lackadaisical in their performance. And you saw that really top to bottom. And even without Malkin, even without Crosby, the Pittsburgh Penguins are a good enough team that you cannot be that sloppy and that lackadaisical and expect to leave Pittsburgh with a victory.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And if you look at the goals against, Jay Harrison picked up from Carolina, for a 7th, 6th round pick, trade earlier this season. Could barely make get an active roster spot on Carolina, one of the worst teams in the league. He was on for all four goals against, when there was a Jets goalie in it, not counting the empty netter. And, all the goals, you could kind of see him not tying up his guy in front. And I want to blame Andre Pavlik for some of these. But you got to tie up the guy in front. I mean, you can't let David Perron get in there and get a few whacks at it or leave a guy open.
You mentioned David Perron, and it's funny you bring him up, because I tweeted early on in the show. I mean, David Perron was flying, I thought, from the early on in the game last night. I thought David Perron was flying throughout from the puck drop last night right through the end of the game. And it's amazing the effect and the rejuvenating effect that leaving a market like Edmonton downtrodden, the team is going nowhere. There's no positive vibes coming out of a team like Edmonton where David Perron played for the majority of the season. And he gets dropped into Pittsburgh, a team that's got Stanley Cup aspirations, a team that should go deep into the Eastern Conference playoffs. It's amazing the rejuvenating effect that kind of move has on a player and on a career. And David Perron, I thought, was a tremendous force, probably the best forward last night.
Yes.
For the Pittsburgh Penguins. He had jump from the start of the game, got 2 points, and he had a number of quality scoring chances in addition to the goal and the assist that he picked up last night.
Yeah, David Perron, I mean, you look at his numbers in Edmonton, a team that's in the Jack Eichel sweep, takes 19 points, 38 games, and 9 points with the Penguins. 9 points in 9 games. I mean, he won the lottery. I mean, going from the worst team.
You go from the Edmonton Oilers to almost any other team in the NHL. You feel like you're winning the lottery. But you're right. For David Perron, who is a talented player, I mean, the performance we saw in Edmonton was not David Perron. I mean, St. Louis was probably certainly regretting the
yes.
trade. I know they made that trade because there were salary cap ramifications and there were things of that nature when they traded him to Edmonton in exchange for Magnus Pjärvi.
Yeah, and where is he right now? He just got waived this year.
I believe he got waived. He's a guy who's got speed and he doesn't have much else for the, used to play for Edmonton and then played for St. Louis. David Perron is a good hockey player. And it may have gone lost in the shuffle in Pittsburgh, in Edmonton. But you put him on the Pittsburgh Penguins in a position where he can just thrive, playing alongside Crosby or playing alongside Malkin. And that's just a dynamite pickup for the Pittsburgh Penguins, and you got to see that last night, how good he was.
Yeah, and wasn't even playing without Crosby, but another player, the first star of the game yesterday, Chris Letang, career-high 5 assists, coming off, returning from the All-Star break, suffered a concussion from the hit from Zach Rinaldo, a dirty hit. He received an 8-game suspension, but Letang was making great passes all over the place, setting everyone up, being the offensive force that he can be and that this team needs from him if they want to go far from the Penguins, if they want to go far in the playoffs. And he sliced and diced his way through the Jets.
Yeah, Chris Letang, very good player, obviously. That's not any news. Has had injury troubles for the last number of years. I mean, there's some scary injuries. He suffered that stroke last year. He was diagnosed with a hole in his heart, and he seems to be, fortunately, coming back. On Saturday, when we previewed the show, we were both a little bit... We didn't really expect him necessarily to be in the Penguins lineup because he was still suffering from the concussion syndromes, the concussion-like symptoms after the hit by Zach Rinaldo that you just mentioned that got Rinaldo suspended for 8 games. But... He played, obviously, he was healthy enough, getting 5 assists last night, and you could see the offense from the Pittsburgh Penguins really did start with Chris Letang and his ability to move the puck.
I mean, you saw him on the first goal, just a really nice stretch pass from his own end to the Jets' blue line. I mean, when you can break out of your own zone that quickly, you can get so much going, and allows you to get more offensive chances.
Yeah. Can't really talk about the game fully without talking about a couple of decisions, or, you know, in one case, a lack of a decision by the officials.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Jets had the 2-1 lead. They had played this sort of lousy first period, but they were down only 1-0, no big deal. They come out strong in the second period and really take the play to the Penguins for, I would say, probably, you know, the majority of the second period,
right,
maybe except for the last few minutes of the second period. Thorburn gets his 5th, assist from Lowry and Kane. Trouba gets his 5th, assist from Kane and Byfuglien. It's 2-1 Jets. The second period is winding down, and the refs absolutely blow a call. They let the Penguins play with 6 men on the ice.
Around the boards for Martin in behind his own net. And Paul Martin will get it up for Gotchu. Just flips it out towards center ice. 10 seconds to go in the period. Downey across the line. Waiting. Feeds it back for Letang. Will get a shot. Go rebound. They score. 5 seconds to go in the period. The Penguins tie it up at 2 on a nice rush by Steve Downey. And then Letang. Got the rebound and beat Pavlik.
I don't like picking on the officials for the most part. I think they're too easy of a target. And I assume that the NHL has some sort of evaluation method to go back and grade an official's work. The officials in last night's game simply blew that call. The officials last night were Mike Lego and Rob Martel. I don't know anything about either of them, so I can't speak to their body of work in general, because officials are completely anonymous in this day and age, unlike when we saw, you know, in the late 80s, and you knew who every ref was. You knew Carey Fraser. You knew Bill McCreary. I couldn't, if Mike Lego and Rob Martel were sitting in this room, I wouldn't be able to identify them.
Yeah, I mean, the officials, I mean, Andy Van Helmond was was another one that you knew. They had the names on the back. And this is a topic that comes up on this show all the time, but I don't think I could name too many. There's Mick Magoo is one that you know.
Well, Mick Magoo, we see him up in the... Him I can recognize. Yeah, he's up at the MTS Center press box all the time.
He's there, but you don't know the officials. And they did. They blew this call. But, I mean, what are you going to do? The Penguins still had to put the puck in the net.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the Penguins get full marks for doing it. But, you know, the officials blew that call. And I'll give the Jets credit. They fought back in the third period with that, you know, goal. You know, you get scored on early, late in the second period, and it's a tie game, and you're thinking to yourself, oh man, that might be a bit of a backbreaker. But then Adam Lowry, his 6th of the year from Thorburn and Kane, and it's 3-2 Winnipeg.
To spin it around the boards, he put it right on the stick of Kane. He'll flip it out towards center ice. Thorburn will knock it down, drop it for Lowry, across the line, shot, and scores! Lowry off the post and in, and 59 seconds into the third period, Winnipeg regains their lead. It's 3-2 Jets.
3-2 Winnipeg. You're thinking great comeback after that disappointing, disheartening second goal by the Penguins late in the second period.
I was very impressed. I mean, so often I feel like they get scored on late in a period, and it's so disheartening. And how are you going to respond? How are you going to react to it? And the Jets, they came out flying. They came out hard in the third period, and you think you got to give them a lot of credit for rebounding from that awful first period. And Adam Lowry, I mean, it's very similar to one of the Penguins' goals. You know, a bouncing puck comes from high in the air. The defenseman can't really play it. It ends up on Lowry's stick from just inside the blue line, and he rips a very quick shot to Thomas Kreis. Can't see it through the screen, and it goes in. Mm-hmm. A great play in the third line. Another great play by the third line.
Yeah, the third line was a dominating force. Evander Kane with 3 assists, probably one of his better games of the year,
yes,
given his performance. And, you know, look, Chris Thorburn's not a bona fide NHL third liner. I don't think I'm telling any secrets out of school. But with Evander Kane and Chris Thorburn and Adam Lowry, I can see that line working to some extent because they're just going to work hard. That's a line that's going to keep it very simple. Evander Kane's going to do his thing. He's going to shoot from some weird angles, and he's going to try and make some passes that are sort of blind passes, and sometimes they work and sometimes they won't. But that line's going to keep it simple. They're going to work the puck down low. That's a big line. Obviously, Lowry's huge, and he's only going to get bigger when he fills out. Chris Thorburn, he's no small guy, obviously. That line's just going to put the puck deep, and they're going to be able to cycle against some teams, especially like the Penguins, who are not that big on the back end. That line is going to work against the Pittsburgh Penguins, and it did last night, to the Jets' credit.
Yeah, I thought Evander Kane had a great game, and he wasn't doing what he normally is. Maybe take some bad shots. He was hanging on the puck for a bit longer, looking for some nice passes. And Paul Maurice did speak about that. I'm not sure if it was today or yesterday, but you talk about Chris Thorburn. No, he doesn't have the best hands, but one thing he does really well is he's a good skater. He's faster than you think he is, and he is very big and very strong. And those guys can combine and can be greater than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I actually like it. Obviously, the Jets weren't able to keep the momentum going. They end up dropping the game by a 5-3 margin. The two late penalties that the Jets take, the Blake Wheeler penalty, which was a penalty taken deep in the Pittsburgh zone, an offensive zone penalty where he slashes the stick of Bo Bennett and the stick breaks, and it's a call that they're going to make every single game. And then that leads to the David Perron tying goal where Andre Pavlik can't gather the rebound, yeah, and it's sitting there ever for a brief of a second. And then the Brandon Sutter goal, and this is the one that really probably sticks in the craw of Jets coach Paul Maurice. Adam Lowry gets called for a charging penalty against Steve Downey that was just another atrocious call by these officials. And I don't say the Jets didn't lose because of the officials, but there has to be, privately, we'll never know about it, there should be some ramifications for two penalties that are that egregious in that they weren't penalties and the officials made the wrong call.
I mean, I don't think that was, it definitely wasn't charging. He was gliding into him. But I do think there's something where about player safety, Downey got blown up. He's looking down for the puck. He didn't have control. It wasn't like he was skating with it. He's kind of standing there in a bow, and Lowry came as the third guy in and hammered him. I mean, you see this in that.
It's a clean play. It's 100% a clean play.
It was a clean body check, but I don't think he had possession of the puck.
No, he had Downey. It was a clean play. The official's standing right there. He might see Downey get hit hard, and yeah, he sees Lowry's bigger than Downey, but that's a clean play, and the official erred in calling that a penalty, led to the Penguins 4-3 goal, the game-winning goal, and the Penguins go on to win 5-3.
Yeah, well, we see this in football all the time. You can't hit a guy hard in sports anymore because everyone wants to be cautious. Everyone wants to be protective of concussions. But the fact of the matter is, sports like football and like hockey, they're contact sports. Concussions, they're going to happen no matter how hard you try to get them out of the game. It was a clean hit. It was shoulder to chest like you teach it. And it was an unfortunate call by the referees there.
I agree that it was an unfortunate call, and it's something that should be looked at by the NHL head office when they evaluate the officials. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about tomorrow night's Jets-Flyers game in Philadelphia. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
20 minutes past the hour, you're listening to NHL Midweek. You're live on TSN 1290. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting custom-made mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center, 204-487-2226, or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Frank Saravelli of the Philadelphia Daily News is going to join us in about a little under 10 minutes time, give or take, to talk about the Flyers ahead of tomorrow night's Jets-Flyers game in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Flyers are, you know, sort of struggling this year. And I don't know if a lot of people necessarily expected the Flyers to be in the position where they are, which is out of the playoffs. They're about 10 points out of the final playoff spots in the Eastern Conference. They have won two games in a row, though. Last night, they came back. They were down 2-0 to the Phoenix Coyotes, or Arizona Coyotes. I guess I owe a dollar to the Coyotes jar that we have here. We should really develop a Coyotes jar. Anyways. Flyers were down 2-0 to the Arizona Coyotes before they were able to battle back and get three goals, take a 3-2 lead, and end up beating the Coyotes last night, I believe, by a 4-3 margin in overtime. You know, the Flyers aren't realistically, I think, in a playoff spot. They're 10 points out still at this point in time. But given the Eastern Conference and the, you know, I guess lack of talent in the Eastern Conference, everything's possible.
Yeah, Drew, I don't know if you subscribe to Sports Club Stats.
I don't, and really, it drives me crazy.
That people do?
Yeah, like when you tweet out, you know, it's game 42 and the Jets are in a playoff spot, and according to Sports Club Stats, and no fault of their own, but, you know, it drives me crazy when the Jets have a 28% chance of finishing in the top three in the Central Division and an 62% chance of making the playoffs. Well, great. It's game 23. How about we wait until it's, you know, game 73, and then you prop those stats out for me.
The Flyers are pretty much are very out of it, I think.
10 points.
But you know, coming to the year, I looked at the team. They don't have much forward depth, and their defense isn't that great defensively. Mark Streit is a nice offensive defenseman, same with Michael Delzato. But in terms of keeping the pucks out of that, when you have below average goaltending like they have right now, I mean, Steve Mason is out. He's usually pretty good. But you've been going with Ray Emery and 30-plus-year-old rookie Rob Zepp, who used to be playing in Europe. And we saw Rob Zepp here in Winnipeg in December, and the Jets losing that game in overtime after blowing a third-period lead. But I think the Flyers, this is a game the Jets, they got to bounce back and get the 2 points here because the Flyers, I think they're struggling. They do have top talent in Giroux and Voracek, and by top talent, I mean two of the top five players in the league, you could certainly argue. But you got to shut those guys down and hope try to make the other guys on the roster beat you.
Yeah, I would agree that the Flyers very much are top-heavy with Giroux and Voracek. You look at some of the players that they have there, and, I mean, you know, when they traded for RJ Umberger in the offseason, we thought it didn't make a lot of sense then, and he hasn't really justified the Flyers' faith. You know, they traded Scott Hartnell for him, and he's only got 13 points in 49 games. You know, Braden Schenn, oh, he's a good player. Braden Schenn will take 29 points. You know, is he going to be what people thought he was? Probably not. But, you know, he's an okay second-line guy, probably better suited to be a third-line role. Wayne Simmons, always like his game. He's a, you know, a goal scorer. He's going to get 25 goals this year for the Flyers. He's already got 17. But then you look down to their bottom six, and this is where the Jets can really take advantage of them. You know, Ryan White, he's got, you know, he's played one game this year. You got Sean Couturier, who Jets fans always, you know, inexplicably link to Mark Scheifele, as the Jets passed over Couturier when they drafted Mark Scheifele back in 2011. You know, Couturier is a dynamite shutdown third line center. You know, in terms of in his own zone and defensive responsibility, he's one of the top players in the league in that role. Is he ever going to have the offense? It's hard to say. I'm going to say it's unlikely at this point in time. He's probably going to be slightly less than half a point a game. That's generally in and around that era. Peter Straka. I don't know who Peter Straka is. I know who Martin Straka is.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with him. He's played one game.
He's played one game also.
One game this season.
Yeah, so I mean, this isn't a Philadelphia Flyers team that, aside from the top-end talent, is really jumping out at you. The fourth line, Chris Vandeveld, not the golfer, no relation to Jean, as far as I know. You know, Pierre-Edward Bellemare. These aren't, you know, Vincent LeCavalier, who's a shadow of himself. But as we did see here in Winnipeg, this is a guy who, you know, when given an opportunity, no, I shouldn't say when given an opportunity, because he's been given plenty of an opportunity in Philadelphia. On occasion, that's the better way of putting it. On occasion, he can come back and really bite you and show off what made him such a dynamic player. And then on the back end, the Flyers don't really, they're just not good in their own zone. They're not good responsibly on the back end. You look at them on the overall rank, they're 25th in goals against in the NHL. 149 goals given up. They're 29th in the penalty kill. So that's an area where the Jets should really be able to take advantage. Of course, easier said than done, because the Jets have not received, did not receive a power play at all last night in a game in Pittsburgh. And I find that really tough to believe in this day and age in the NHL, where everything is a penalty. I think if I look at you the wrong way and I, you know, maybe I sneeze on you, it's a penalty. That the Jets didn't get a power play opportunity last night against Pittsburgh. I don't think that's going to happen again against the Flyers, as the Jets should be able to skate and take advantage of a poor Philadelphia defense.
Do the refs have it in for the Jets, Drew? Or are we making too much about this? Because it seems like every game the Jets are getting screwed out of a penalty. They're getting a bad call against them. Are we just living in a world where every call is just so heavily scrutinized? Because it doesn't seem like the Jets have been getting some tough luck when it comes to calls from the officials.
I don't think that we're making... I think the Jets are the most penalized team in the NHL, and as a result, you're going to be watched with scrutiny. Should that translate to when you think you're the victim of a penalty? I don't know that it necessarily should, but to some extent, you know, I say that I expect that the Jets should get some, should have had a power play, or it's unusual for the Jets to not go to go without a power play in a game. Look back at last night's game against Pittsburgh. I can't really identify any glaring missed calls, you know, that the Jets were should have received a power play on.
Yeah, I can't think of too many about that, but you would think. I think there's one.
Well, the too many men on the ice one, I suppose, is a glaring mistake. But aside from that, when you look at, you know, stick fouls, or you look at holding or things of that nature, the ones that are, you know, the penalties that are most frequently called.
Well, look, the Jets only took three penalties in that game, and one of them
below their average
was one of them was Blake Wheeler
slashing the stick,
being a little too active with the stick, and one was Adam Lowry, which we've debated as questionable.
Yeah.
So really, they only took one penalty if you think about it. Obviously they didn't take one, but
I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, you can eliminate that part of the game, the Blake Wheeler being a little too aggressive in the offensive zone.
You know, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. I think the Jets should be able to take advantage of the Philadelphia Flyers tomorrow, especially the Flyers' weakened defense. And if the Jets can shut down Voracek and Giroux, because that's really who you're targeting. You know, you're saying Voracek and Giroux, you guys aren't going to beat me. You know, if Chris Vandeveld ends up beating me, well, so be it. It's probably not ideal, but you're not letting Giroux and Voracek do it. That's who you're targeting to shut down. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to bring in Frank Saravelli from the Philadelphia Daily News. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
6:30 in the evening. Beautiful Winnipeg, Manitoba. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the Philadelphia Daily News, Frank Saravelli. Frank, how's life?
Life is great, guys. How are you?
Doing very well ourselves. It's unseasonably warm here in Winnipeg, so we're happy about that.
Like 2 or 3 today?
Well, if you want, you're going to make me do some quick math for Fahrenheit. It's about 32 degrees Fahrenheit, so really it is unseasonably warm.
That is incredible. I think it was actually colder here today. It's actually, looking at my my car here, it's -1 or -2°C, so... Yeah. You know, we're right on par here.
Exactly. You never thought you'd see a day when Winnipeg and Philadelphia would have the same weather at the end of January, did you?
No, that's definitely true.
Frank obviously brought you on to talk about tomorrow night's Jets-Flyers game in Philadelphia, the Jets' lone visit to Philadelphia this season. The Flyers were here at the end of December, where Rob Zepp got his first career NHL victory. We'll start, I guess, with the goaltenders. You know, we had the Flyers had Ray Emery start last night against Arizona. He got pulled early in the game after giving up two quick goals. Steve Mason comes in. He ends up getting the victory for the Flyers. Who are you expecting to be in net for the Flyers tomorrow?
I definitely think it would be Steve Mason in net, just because he did play so well against Arizona. And I think my issue with the way that the Flyers handled that entire situation on Tuesday against Arizona was the fact that Mason had not practiced at all. He left a game in January 10th against the Bruins with an injury, and he really seemed like he was heading toward an injury all week. He had a couple different situations where he was slow getting up, and then he missed a practice because he needed an MRI for his injury, and all of a sudden he still played, and then finally he sits out all this time. He sits out, obviously, during the Olympic break. He didn't practice at all. He was actually sick and missed practice on Monday, the first day out of the break, and then he went to Coach Craig Berube and said that he was good enough to back up. But I asked Craig Berube and said, what is good enough to back up even mean? Like, does that mean you're good enough to start? And he, of course, admitted that good enough to back up means just that and not anything more. And he was concerned about Steve Mason's lack of practice time, which was the first time the coach had admitted that he perhaps used Steve in a situation that he was not comfortable with. But Steve ends up going in and playing extremely well, stopping all three shots in the shootout. He was flawless, only gave up one goal on 24 shots, and he practiced today and said he felt great, which leads me to believe he'll be in against the Jets, but it's really kind of turning into a circus here.
You know, the Flyers' goals against this year, not very good. I mean, 25th in the NHL. How much of that is a function of the defense versus the play of Steve Mason, rather? Because his numbers aren't bad. You know, 2.4 goals against average and a .920 save percentage. Flyers would probably take that from Steve Mason.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, I think it all hinges on the Flyers' defense. But before I get to that, let me tell you how good Steve Mason has been for this team. He's fourth in the NHL in save percentage. His save percentage is .921 among goaltenders who have played half of their team's games this season. That's one. Number two is the Flyers have the 29th ranked penalty kill in the NHL, and it's been brutal all season long. And Steve Mason, when you take the penalty kill out of the mix, has a .942 save percentage this season, wow, which would be tops in the NHL at even strength. He's been absolutely outstanding for this team. And I know people rag on Steve Mason for his tenure in Columbus, the way that it ended up there. He ended up being a running joke. And, you know, it was certainly embarrassing for him, but he's rekindled his career. He's a young guy. He's still only 26. He has a manageable salary cap hit. And for a team that isn't spending huge dollars on goaltending like they were with Ilya Brizgalov, he's the perfect fit for this team moving forward to build around. And I think this defense is exactly what they're not trying to build around based on the way that they've played. They're really in a tough situation because they have guys that are on contracts for the next few seasons. Braden Coburn has a deal next year. Nick Grossman has one. Mark Streit, of course, is signed long-term. Andrew McDonald, a guy who was a healthy scratch, has 5 years remaining on his deal. There's a bunch of guys that this team really should try and move, and the future of the Flyers is going to be on their defense. And until they can get some of their prospects up and into the NHL and develop, they're going to be in a tough spot.
You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Frank Saravelli from the Philadelphia Daily News. Frank, you mentioned the back end, and we're in agreement that that's the bulk of where the Flyers' goals against problem comes from. And you mentioned that all these guys are under long-term deals. You know, McDonald and Streit are under long-term deals. Luke Shen's got another year after this one. You know, but in the junior ranks, in the system, it's looking pretty good for the back end. You got Travis Sanheim, first-round pick this past year. Samuel Morin, a first-round pick from a couple years ago. You got Shane Gostisbehere, who's, you know, third-round pick in 2012. When are these guys going to be ready to step in and maybe solidify that Flyers' back end?
Well, that's the thing, is kind of the catch too, is I think the Flyers would probably be more interested in being certainly Sam Morin and Shane Gostisbehere into the lineup next season. I mean, Morin was very close to breaking camp with this team, and if there were probably open spots, he would have, even though I don't think he's ready. But Shane Gostisbehere, to me, is certainly ready. He was the Flyers' best defenseman in training camp already this year. He ended up coming up and playing a couple games, but then tore his ACL. But that's all those guys are all well and good, and I actually think Manitoba boy Travis Sanheim might end up being the best out of all of them. But without any room on your salary cap, obviously you can't bury these contracts, they're going to be in trouble, and there's nowhere to put these guys. And that's why I think Ron Hextall really needs to seriously consider moving some of these pieces at the deadline, even if you're not getting anything in return for them. You know, might get a sixth-round pick or a seventh-round pick or whatever, just to get those contracts off your books. Maybe you can get a guy like Nick Grossman to a team that's in need of bodies for the playoffs, a playoff contender that was just looking for a good seventh guy to have around. And I think the interesting thing is the Jets are probably in a little bit of the same position, because now they're getting healthy finally, and they're going to have some guys that they're going to need to make decisions about moving forward, just to try and free up some space, some roster space for these guys.
Yeah, you're right about that. We're joined by Frank Saravelli of the Philadelphia Daily News. Frank, Flyers, obviously a good comeback win last night against Arizona. There was the game against Pittsburgh right before the break that had the Zach Rinaldo incident, but a win for the Flyers there as well. Is there still an eye on the playoffs in the dressing room, or is this team realistically playing for next year at this point in time?
Well, I think realistically they won't say this, but I really do think that the players know what kind of situation they're in. I think there's still, you know, a glimmer of hope. Jake Voracek said yesterday that this team needs to win 25 out of their remaining 34 games. That was before the win against Arizona. So now it's 24 and 33. It's a ridiculous number. I think in their heart of hearts, they understand that they're not really playing for a whole lot this season. I think it's just really tough in this league to make up ground when you're so far behind. You look at Columbus, they went 10-1-1 in December and only gained 3 points in the standings in that time. You got the teams ahead of them are going to be really tough to beat. Boston is that team that's on the fringe now. Even the Rangers, who, if you watch a lot of their games, have been outplayed in some of those games. They've won a lot because of Henrik Lundqvist, and I think he's exactly the reason that they keep their spot exactly where it is in the standings, if not climb a little bit more. And it's just really hard to make up ground in this league, and I think the Flyers are realizing exactly what they've done. And I think in a lot of ways people are realizing here that the East is better than it was last year. The Jets certainly have, you know, played really well against the East this year, all things considered, without the two teams from Pennsylvania in the mix. But the East is better, for one, for the Flyers this year, and two, I think people are realizing that the Flyers just really aren't that good as assembled.
Jets still looking for their win against they have a Pennsylvania bugaboo they have to get over that they'll try and do tomorrow night when the Jets and the Flyers play in Philadelphia. Frank, moving to the top, to the forward group in Philly. I mean, any team that starts with Voracek and Giroux is going to be a class of the NHL in terms of forwards. And then, you know, Wayne Simmonds, certainly no slouch himself. Braden Shen, maybe not developed into what people thought he would be, but still also a good quality forward. The bottom six on the Flyers, though, it's not really a who's who of NHLers. In the case of Vincent LeCavalier, it's, I guess, a has-been of NHLers. Is that the priority for Ron Hextall next year, to really, you know, shore up the bottom six forward group?
I think it's certainly a priority, but like I said, the priority is getting rid of contracts that are hindering your team. And I think that would also extend to some of the forward positions as well. If you could move Vinny LeCavalier, the Flyers should do it. Doesn't matter what the return is. Even if you need to pay half of the salary and half of his cap hit, just having that dead space for Vinny LeCavalier on your cap, half of it, it's better than carrying the whole thing and just getting the production that they're getting out of him, which isn't very much. I think there's other guys that this team really needs to try and move as well. RJ Umberger is a guy who was this close to being bought out by Columbus last year, and the Flyers end up trading Scott Hartnell for him. And Scott Hartnell started off pretty strong for Columbus this year, but he's really kind of dialed it back a little bit. But still, he has double the amount of points that RJ Umberger has at this point, more than double, actually. The Flyers, you're right, the Flyers are a pretty thin team when you look at their forward group. And I think at a certain point, when you're looking long-term for this team, you have the defensive prospects that you mentioned. You have Giroux and Voracek. You have Mason. And I think after that, everyone else should be up for grabs. I think that should include Braden Shen. I think that should include Wayne Simmonds. Wayne Simmonds is a nice piece, and 30-goal scorers don't exactly grow on trees. He's had 29 and 28 the last 2 years. But to be honest, I think that you would have to consider moving a guy like Wayne, because he's maybe the one guy or two guys on your team that you could move that can really help jumpstart that rebuilding process and get a few really quality pieces in there for this team that can help this team bottom out and move forward, because that's what they really need to do.
Frank, we'll let you go on this last question. It's about head coach Craig Berube. We know that Ron Hextall, you know, became general manager after Berube was hired, and there's always the thought that, you know, the general manager gets to pick his coach, and the coach is always in trouble when a new general manager is hired. You know, if the Flyers don't end up making the playoffs, is Craig Berube in trouble, or is he in trouble right now? And, you know, is it a fair situation, or just sort of a function of what happens when a new general manager takes over?
I think it's a function of what happens when you're handed a team that isn't very good, to be honest. he's, to put it bluntly, I guess, he's a guy that made made something out of this team last year, and a lot of people will point to that and say, okay, well, if you did it last year, why can't you do it this year? The difference is they turned it around sort of right away last year. They did it starting in the first week of November, which left a lot of time to really get back in the standings. And I think also it is a function of not being the GM's guy. I think it's a function of being in a market where a lot's expected of both the coach, the GM, and the players. And I think, you know, he's really just sort of stuck in the circumstance at this point. Is he, the thing that you need to ask yourself is Craig Berube the guy that we want to be coaching this team in 3 years from now when there finally are the pieces together that you'd want to have on the ice? And I'm not so sure that he's going to be the guy that lasts all that time. And if that's the case, then you might as well bring in a guy that, you know, can get a lot out of a little. And there's been quite a few guys that have done that in the NHL. I think one of the hot names that's going to continue to come up is going to be Mike Babcock. And a lot of people are pointing to Toronto. But the Flyers are also a team that spends money. I think that they would be really interested in bringing him in. And you just look at what he's done in Detroit. There really aren't a lot of rock star players on that team. And I think, you know, they've continued their playoff streak over the last few years. Despite a lot of injuries and despite not having perhaps the top-end talent that Detroit has been used to. And so to me, he'd be one of those guys that's perfect to bring in.
Well, if they do end up getting Mike Babcock, it's unlikely they'll have to even consider using a buyout on him at any point in time. Frank Saravelli is with the Philadelphia Daily News. Frank, thanks very much for doing this. Always appreciate your time.
All right, great. Thanks a lot for having me, guys. Take care.
Take care, Frank. Thanks very much. Let's head to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. The podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, a big thank you to Frank Saravelli of the Philadelphia Daily News for joining us to discuss tomorrow evening's Jets-Flyers game. A game, of course, you can hear on TSN1290. You can also watch it on TSN3. Paul Edmonds, Brian Munns with the call on TSN 1290. Dennis Bayak, Shane Knighty with the call on TSN 3. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Welcome back to NHL Midweek. This segment of the show is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. Conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or eat in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. Reminder, this coming Saturday, Bernstein's Deli on the ice at the foot of the Forks as part of the Raw Almond Culinary Extravaganza. Brunch served from 9 a.m. on Saturday. So you can check that out if you're looking for something to do. Come Saturday morning, a good place to have brunch. Go have it in the river. Literally on the river, in the river, depends on really how you look at it. I don't know if you saw Remo, but Richie was there last Sunday for brunch, of course.
Yes, I thought I recognized him on the Instagram.
On the Instagram photo, he was there having brunch. People walk into the tent. It's a public tent. They're coming for dinner or coming for lunch, you think. They got married. People got married. They walked right in.
Really?
And got married at Raw Almond. As Bernstein's Deli was doing, was hosting brunch.
Was this a planned thing, or was it like a flash mob, or was it a flash wedding?
I'm not 100% sure. I haven't really been able to decipher the details. I think Richie himself, who was in attendance,
yes,
was also a little confused as to why there were people getting married all of a sudden.
It was a real thing. It wasn't like an act.
I can't say for sure.
Yes.
But it did seem, based on everything I saw on social media, and of course, everything you see on social media is 100% true. Take it to the bank. It's a guarantee that whatever you have heard, you think you've heard, you've seen, it's exactly true. Got married.
Good for them. Hey, I think that's actually a really nice wedding. Some people want to go to Hawaii and do it on the ocean, but doing it on a frozen river, it sounds kind of nice.
Have you and the missus ever considered, you know, getting married on the river?
No. I think I'm more of a summer guy.
You're more of a summer guy.
If I ever had to choose.
A traditionalist. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. Mike Richards of the Manchester Monarchs?
Yeah, I guess so. Isn't that right, Drew?
That would be. Put on waivers earlier this week by the Los Angeles Kings. Nobody claimed him, no surprise given his contract. $22 million left on the contract and five more years.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of talk if maybe the Jets should put in a claim or...
Not at that price.
Or Pierre LeBrun was saying they were trying to trade for him. But the bottom line is it's too much money, too many years commitment for any team in the league to consider doing this. And this, they had a chance to buy him out in the offseason. They won the Stanley Cup and were on a bit of a high. And it might have that high of winning the Cup clouded Dean Lombardi's vision for the team. And they should have bought him out when they had the chance. And now it's kind of shooting themselves in the foot here.
I agree, you know, with your assessment there that the high of winning the Stanley Cup may have clouded his judgment. He, you know, here is Dean Lombardi, what he said yesterday. If you're going to expect loyalty from your players, then you at times have to show loyalty to them. Under the circumstances, with what he had done for us, I thought he deserved a chance to get back to where he knows he's capable of. You think about it and you work through the process, said Dean Lombardi. I think it's fair to say that we made a final decision on this, that we were one way or another going to make a move after the All-Star break. I'm sure it's not easy on anybody, but these are tough decisions you've got to make. I think he made an error. Yes. Mike Richards was subject of a lot of rumors last season. Didn't play very well during the course of the regular season last year. Played better come in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Was probably a valuable member of the Philadelphia Flyers. And certainly, you know, deserves credit for everything he's done in LA. Two Stanley Cups, you know, certainly wins everywhere he goes. But the contract that he, you know, is attached to him is really, it's an albatross, given his recent performance.
Yes, I mean, as I think Mike Richards is a quality NHL player. He could be on the third or the fourth line. He would fit nicely on any team, but not at the price that he's at and at the long term. And it's too bad. It's an unfortunate situation. It reminds me of, you know, Robert Luongo last year saying, my contract sucks. And if Mike Richards
difference,
could talk,
difference there.
Different situation. It's more of a rape.
Roberto Luongo is still a bona fide number one goaltender. Mike Richards is... Well, I mean, obviously the Los Angeles Kings think, you know, that he isn't as, you know, isn't good enough to play on their team, at least at that cap hit.
Yeah, I mean,
because they probably at $1.5 million, he's probably not going anywhere.
Fine. I mean, it's more reminiscent of Wade Redden. I mean, yeah. Bring a guy in the minors to get some salary cap relief, at least. And we know the Kings are hurting on defense. The Slavin Voinov off ice incident has really hurt them on the blue line. And I mean, obviously, he shouldn't be playing. We agree with that. But in terms of a hockey sense, it hasn't helped their team at all. And the Kings are on the outside looking in. A little, you know, right now they're out of a playoff spot. They got to turn things around here real quick if they want to get in there come April.
Here's Ray Ferraro talking about what the Kings should have done with Mike Richards.
Dean Lombardi must just kick himself in the shins for not buying him out last year. After they won. He doesn't make many mistakes. That was a huge blunder that's going to have long-term ramifications for the Kings. They can put him on waivers three times this week. He's not getting picked up. His game has deteriorated over the last couple of years. He's just not fast enough to play the role you need him to play at the money you're paying him. Now, you can say, hey, look, the trade-off is they won two Stanley Cup, but you could have made a decision last spring that would have alleviated all of it.
You know, he talks about the decision. We talk about, you know, Dean Lombardi kicking himself. And I look at Bill Belichick, and I know it's not the exact same situation. But Bill Belichick, loyalty doesn't matter. And some people say, you know, some people criticize Bill Belichick for that. And certainly, you know, it's a bit of a cruel way to go about things.
Yes.
But, you know, Bill Belichick, first and foremost, is what have you done for me lately?
I remember, I know we're going back over 10 years, when they cut Lawyer Malloy, that was kind of the first, I know we're talking football and a hockey show, but I mean, it's the same thing.
There's parallels.
He was a great player, very loyal, and at the time where he was deteriorating slightly, you got rid of him. They did the same thing with Richard Seymour when they traded him to Oakland.
Yeah.
And
look at what they did with Logan Mankins this year.
Oh yeah, same thing too.
Logan Mankins, they traded him to Tampa Bay, to the Buccaneers. They get Tim Dwight.
Yeah.
Tim Dwight.
That's the
old kick returner
for San Diego and Atlanta.
That's right.
Tim Wright, was it?
Yeah, I think it's Tim Wright. He's a tight end. You're right. Yes. Tim Wright, Tim Dwight. Tim Wright and a draft pick in exchange for Logan Mankins.
Yeah.
And going back to the LA Kings, Dean Lombardi just, you know, held on to him for a little bit too long.
Yeah.
And you know, Mike Richards is going to do, you know, I think he'll be back in the NHL because there's no more re-entry waivers like there was that kept Wade Redden down in the minors for so long. Mm-hmm. You know, he can come back and there's not a chance, you know, that you know, there's none of the perils of recalling him like there was in the previous collective bargaining agreement. So I expect he's going to be back with the Kings maybe when the salary cap loosens up a little bit. But even this offseason, I think that Mike Richards is probably a pretty significant buyout candidate for the Kings. And I know last year, had they done it, it wouldn't have cost them anything. They could do it for free. This year, if you buy him out, he's got $22 million left on his contract and 5 years. So you take two-thirds of $22 million, that's about $14.67 million. He's got 5 years left. So you buy him out so you can double the payments over twice the remaining length of time. So you take two-thirds of $22 million, that's $14.67 million. You take 10 years, and so you're going to pay Mike Richards $1.467 million a year for the next 10 years to not play for your team, and it gets you really out from underneath the big salary cap hit of $5.75 million. I think that's a decent trade-off, and that's how I'd expect this situation to get resolved in Los Angeles. Not ideal. Obviously, no general manager ever wants to pay a player to go away.
Yeah.
But we're talking about the LA Kings, their deep pockets, $1.5 million, a little less than that for the next 10 years, isn't the end of the world. Because if you hold on to Mike Richards, or maybe you're able to trade him, and he retires with a year or 2 years left on his contract, and you get hit with that huge cap recapture penalty, if Mike Richards retires with 1 year left on his deal, you know, he plays another 3 years, plays another 4 years, the Kings are going to get hit with a $6 million salary cap hit for that 1 year for a guy who's retired.
You really think he's going to retire? I mean, he's only, 29 now?
Yeah, if he can't play, let's say he goes to another team, or he comes back and maybe he can stretch his career out for another 3 years? Can he stretch it out for another 5 years? I don't think so.
He's making millions of dollars. Either way, I think he can still play. Wow. I mean, if he's in the AHL, making millions, so you're in the AHL, but look at your bank account. It's looking pretty good.
Yeah, but, that's a fair point. I understand, you're leaving money on the table, but maybe, you play in the AHL for long enough when you think you're an NHL player, or you remember the good old days of flying luxury planes and charters all the time, as opposed to riding the bus through Manchester and Peoria and Utica and Albany and Rochester. I might want to retire to a nice life in Los Angeles as well.
Although, to be fair, next year, LA's farm club is moving to Ontario.
Right.
They're taking place of Ontario Reign, and the AHL is creating a new West Division.
Fair enough.
A number of teams in California. So, hey, you could still enjoy the California sun next year.
Ontario, California, not Ontario, the province in Canada.
That's correct.
Nice. Anyways, it'll be interesting to see with the LA Kings and how Mike Richards' future unfolds. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Michael Trakos of the National Post. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One hour down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with The Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel alongside Michael Remus in studio with you this Wednesday evening. Earlier, I had the opportunity to sit down with Michael Trakos of the National Post. Here is my interview with Michael Trakos.
You have a new article in the National Post. It was published a couple days ago. I'll tweet it out now on our Twitter feed, at Illegal Curve. The headline, of course, which you're not responsible for, but the headline and the gist of the article is Toronto Maple Leafs sniper Phil Kessel's best good enough for the Toronto Maple Leafs? And, Michael, let's start sort of on the topic of Kessel, and then we'll move to the Leafs in general. He really receives a lot of attention and a lot of criticism in Toronto. How much of that criticism, in your mind, is fair and or unfair?
That's a difficult question because I think parts of it is, I think it's almost like a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. And first off, I think a lot of it is unfair just because when you look at Phil Kessel, he's almost on into an island on himself. He's obviously one of the elite snipers in the NHL and possibly of his generation. And possibly of all time when you look at the all-time Leafs best scorers. And yet, he's basically surrounded by mediocre, kind of B-list type talent. Doesn't have a great supporting cast. So right there, I think a lot of the criticism is unfair. But then the flip side is, when you look at Kessler, I think this is the infuriating part. You look at him and everything seems to come so easy. And when you're watching him, it's almost similar to, and a colleague of mine said it, it's almost similar to the Raptors and Vince Carter, where as good as Vince was and as good as Phil's been, there's still more to give. And I think that's the infuriating part for fans, is that they say, as good as he's been right now, what would this guy look like had he been of the same work ethic of a Sidney Crosby or a Jonathan Toews, and he took his game that seriously and played in all three zones, and then you'd probably have arguably the best player in the NHL. So I think that's the that's where you get a lot of the love-hate kind of criticism with Phil Kessel.
You look at Kessel's career, and almost from day one, back when he was, you know, in Wisconsin and he was just tearing up the junior leagues there, and that's sort of been his reputation all along. Is it unfair to expect anything different from him at this point? Isn't he sort of, he is what he is, to use the cliche there?
Yeah, it's funny, because when the article was published, I got a call from a college coach who had coached against Kessel at that time. He's like, everything that you see today with Phil Kessel is how he's been from basically a freshman. And he said he'd been watching him even since he was a teenager, playing in the under the national development team in the U.S. And he said, he goes, that's just one of the things that coaches have had to live with. And it goes even back to a guy like Bob Cedar, who was on the U.S. Miracle team that won gold at the 80 Olympics. And he coached Kessel from the age of 7 to 14, and he was even trying to bring out that more complete player out of Phil. And you look at Ryan Cedar, and there's a guy that is completely the opposite in terms of, I don't think you look at Ryan Cedar and go, oh, he's got more to give. I wish this guy was just playing with 100% effort. No. But with Kessel, though, it's quite the opposite, where he scores all these goals, and how can you really criticize him? And yet, like I said, there's just a little bit more to give, and I think that's kind of what his kind of mantra has been all his life.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking with Michael Trakos of the National Post, discussing Phil Kessel and the Leafs in general. Michael, you mentioned Bob Suter, you know, the influence that he had on Phil Kessel. You know, do you think that, I don't know if it's too simplistic to say that Bob Suter was a mentor for Phil Kessel, but do you think that it would be important for Kessel to have somebody like that in his life now to sort of be that sounding board? And you know, I know it's not easy to develop a relationship with that of that kind of level, but is that something that really would help Kessel, to your mind?
I think so. I mean, you know what? Just talking to him about Bob Suter, and Phil gets really emotional. And the thing that stood out when he was talking about him, he said Bob wasn't necessarily a yes guy with Phil. He really pushed him, and that's what Phil was saying. He's like, he wouldn't be here without Bob. He pushed him very hard. He's like, and he couldn't get into specifics, and they were really trying to like pull out an anecdote out of him. But he goes, you just don't understand. He's like, this guy was not easy on me. And I wonder if Phil kind of needs that kind of coach, a guy that's really, or maybe not even a coach, but maybe a guy in the dressing room, like a Jonathan Toews or a Sidney Crosby, who, when you look at what Toews has been able to do with Kane as a line mate, and Patrick Kane very much is Phil Kessel, except Kane plays in Chicago on a team that wins Stanley Cup. So what would Phil Kessel look like if he had a teammate like Jonathan Toews? Well, then maybe you'd get him to buy in more. And if you had him more of a strong, like you just said, like a mentor in his life or just as a lineman. And you look up and down Toronto's roster, and I think that's been a glaring, aside from the fact that maybe they don't have a number one defenseman, they don't have a number one center, they don't have a number one leader that holds players accountable. And I think that's maybe holding Phil back, to be honest.
At the All-Star Weekend, we saw sort of Phil Kessel was almost the face of the All-Star Weekend to some degree, or he was certainly front and center, which is hard to believe given how media shy he generally is. You know, given all the comments from the other All-Stars that regarding Phil Kessel, you know, Toews with the most coachable player out there joke, and then Kessel being traded for Sagan at the All-Star Draft. You know, to you, was that a sign that the players really respect and appreciate what Phil Kessel brings more than maybe the general public does?
I think so. A couple of people said to me, they're like, wow, Kessler really got mocked of it. It seems like a lot of guys don't think highly of him. And I'm like, you guys got it all wrong. If Jonathan Toews didn't like Phil Kessler, didn't think much of him, he doesn't even think about him at the draft. He doesn't even care to draft him or to kind of make him a sort of butt of joke. So I think that was a sign that Toews really does have a soft spot for Phil. And I talked to a couple of players, and just even off the record, and they were saying that they kind of feel sorry for what he's gone through in Toronto, especially this year. And let's be honest, as much as a lot of people outside Toronto hate to admit it, it's very much the center of the NHL, the center of the hockey universe. It's cliche. It kind of rings true with a lot of hockey players. They know what's going on here. They pay a lot of attention. And guys like Toews, guys like Sagan, guys like Kevin Shattenkirk, a lot of the All-Stars, have a lot of respect for what Phil Kessler can do on the ice. And to see him getting treated this way, with Ron Wilson calling him uncoachable, or with certain reporters were really taking it out on him and kind of make him the reason why this team is not succeeding, I think a lot of players really fell for Kessler. And I think we saw it at this year's All-Star draft. I didn't see a guy that was kind of a loner or a guy that was really kind of taking his lumps by the other guys. I saw a guy that was really welcomed, and like you just said, Jonathan Toews, I think, had his back all weekend.
One more question on Phil Kessel before we move on to other topics in Leafs land. You know, are the Leafs possibly, are they a better team without Phil Kessel? Or do you think he's a key component of this team moving forward and hopefully for Leafs fans, you know, a key component in seeing the Leafs improve their fortunes on the ice?
You know, that's a tough question because I think it all depends on if Phil Kessel's in your lineup, does that impede management from getting a Jonathan Toews-type guy or a Duncan Keith-type defenseman? Is it almost like an Alex Ovechkin thing where if you're going to have Alex, you're not going to have the other pieces because you're paying him so much and this is going to be your star player? So that's a tough one. I think really it comes down to they have to surround them with certain players, but you look at the Boston Bruins. They were able to trade Phil Kessel, but they're also able to trade a Tyler Seguin and a Joe Thornton. And for all intents and purposes, they seem a better team for those kind of moves. So it's really difficult to say unless we look at what Phil Kessel could possibly bring in return. And if it's a number one, a first-round draft pick and a really top prospect and a really good roster player that really kind of balances out your lineup, then maybe you are better without him.
You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. We're joined by Michael Tracos of the National Post. Michael, trade deadline's in give or take about 5 weeks from now. Who in the Leafs front office is making the decisions regarding any potential trades?
Your guess might be as good as mine, man. I'm confused. Like, I go to the games, I look in the press box, I see Brennan Shanahan on one side of the press box, I see Dave Nonis, Kyle Dubas on the other side, and I honestly wonder who is making the moves. Is it Dave Nonis? Does he have to go and ask permission from Brendan Shanahan, or is he been neutered to the fact that he doesn't even get to make a move? So, to be honest, I literally am confused right now. I guess we'll find out what types of moves are made, and I guess we'll infer as to whether that was a Nonis type trade or possibly a Shanahan or a Kyle Dubas analytics type trade. So, I don't know.
I'm sure that's music to the ears of Leafs fans that the guy covering the team on a daily basis isn't sure who's making the decisions.
Yeah, well, that's kind of how this year has worked. You get the feeling that Nonis is in the position, and yet a lot of the moves are kind of head scratching moves. They don't go kind of necessarily fit in with what Nonis has done in the past. So ideally, and maybe this is giving them too much credit, but you'd like to think that everyone is getting some sort of input, and that's following the Detroit Red Wings model where it was Jim Neal advising Ken Holland and Ken Holland relying on guys like Jimmy Devolano and maybe at the time Steve Yzerman, and it was a great harmonious kind of management team. I don't know if that's necessarily the case in Toronto, but that's how they're trying to portray it. I'm skeptical right now.
You're listening to NHL Midweek. Our guest is Michael Tracos of the National Post, discussing Phil Kessel, discussing the Toronto Maple Leafs. Michael, there are a number of reports out in the last couple of weeks that the Leafs are discussing a contract extension with Nazem Kadri, and the number, the years, has been said 5 years is what apparently is on the table. Do the Leafs really know what they have with Kadri? And if not, why the rush to sign him to such a long-term deal?
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think they completely know what they have with Naz, in the same sense that they don't know what they have with Jake Gardner or a lot of the young guys. And let's be honest, these guys aren't necessarily young anymore. Kadri is a 1990 birthday, so he's same draft as a Jonathan Tavares. And I don't know if you necessarily call John Tavares young anymore. He's a guy that...
You call him one of the best players in hockey, though.
Yeah, you know who you got with him. You know he's an elite center. He's an Olympic player. With Kadri, is he a number two center? Could he be a number one center? On most teams, or on most good teams, is he going to be a number three center? I think that's a difficulty, and it comes just down to his consistency. Last year, he got 20 goals, 50 points. Right now, he's sitting roughly at the halfway mark with 13 goals and 27 points. While his five-on-five play has been really good in terms of possession numbers, and he's been putting up a lot of even strength points, he hasn't been really padding the stats of those power play points that a lot of good players do. So with Naz, I think maybe you go long-term thinking that maybe next year is going to be his breakout year and you save some money that way. But these are the difficult decisions that the Leafs kind of have to make. And it's not just, like I said, with Kadri. I think with Jonathan Bernier, there's still maybe a little bit of second-guessing because this year was his year to really put up elite numbers, and we haven't seen that out of him as well. And while Cody Franzen is coming up on his UFA contract, he's a guy that you're probably looking at hopefully trying to keep. But again, with this defense core, a lot of people are saying, why would you keep any of these guys? Everyone seems to be underperforming, so... There's a lot of tough decisions for management just because the team has been so awful this year.
You mentioned Cody Franzen, and that leads perfect into my next question. A lot of talk that he's going to be dealt before the trade deadline. You know, is it just a function of he's going to want too much money on the open market when he hits UFA status on July 1st?
I think so. And I think a lot of it goes back to history. Like, this guy has been... really put through the ringer every year that he comes on restricted free agency. So it's been three straight years, really, where the Leafs have really not made it easy on. In his mind or his agent's mind, I think they'd have to say that they've lowballed Cody Franzen. So now that he's putting up, he's top 15 in scoring, leads the Leafs in all offensive categories. I think he's second in hits, first in block shots. This is his biggest year that he's had as a Leaf, and he's really kind of taken a leadership role with the team, too. So when you look at that open market, there's very few right-handed shots, and a guy like, or a team like Detroit would love to have a Cody Franzen, whether it's in a trade or an unrestricted free agency. So it's going to be real tough for the Leafs to, A, try to sign him, and B, try to sign him for what Cody Franzen is probably going to demand. And when you look at how much Deion Phaneuf is making, there's no reason why Cody Franzen shouldn't be just below that number.
Michael, we'll leave it on an optimistic note for Leafs fans, as you know, there has been a lot of optimism in Toronto so far this year. Michael Nylander, 2014 first-round pick. He's playing for the Marlies in the AHL at this point in the season. How has he looked so far?
I think you meant William Nylander.
Yes, William Nylander.
I made that mistake myself, so don't worry.
Yes.
At least you didn't say it in print where you can't take it back.
I'm sure you get plenty of emails from very calm, rational people when you do that.
Of course. You know, they allow me to make mistakes. They're so forgiving.
Yeah.
But, William Nylander's only played two games in the AHL, but, you know, based on what he did with Moto, he was putting up numbers along the lines of, like, Peter Forsberg, Matt Sundin, the Sedin twins. He's just fantastic. I think he had like 20 points in 21 games in a Swedish elite league. So he's coming here now. He's played two games already. He has nothing to show for it yet. There's a lot of potential with this guy. And I saw him at the World Juniors. He was fantastic for Sweden, one of their best players. So I think ESPN just ranked him the best player and currently not in the NHL right now. So Leaf fans, there's a lot to look forward to, and this guy could quite possibly maybe be your number one center. And if he's not playing the center position, he's probably going to be your number one, or sorry, one of the top wingers. So a lot of things to look forward to looking at some of the prospects we have.
I lied when I said that was the last question. Are they going to let him develop fully? Or, I mean, are they going to potentially rush him along? Because there's some people that said that they rushed Nazem Kadri up to the big to the NHL too quickly. Is there a sort of a different approach that's going to be taken for William Nylander, given that really the Leafs aren't going to be any sort of contender or threat for at least a couple seasons?
From what I'm hearing, they are. I think it goes back to what Shanahan saw in Detroit, where guys like Gustav Nyquist and Jonathan Erickson really spent arguably too long in the minors before they actually got their shot. So you hope that they could do the same thing in Toronto. The only difference in Detroit and Toronto is, well, Detroit, you had players that were occupying spots that guys like Nyquist and Erickson couldn't take. As good, as bad as the Leafs have looked right now, you could arguably put Nylander in the lineup and he'd probably help you. So that, I think that's going to be the challenge, is when you're looking at a guy who's arguably better than some of the options they have right now and saying, okay, well, we're still going to keep him down there, even if it means we're going to lose a couple more games because we're trying to do what's best for him. So we'll see what actually happens, but they're trying to take the patient approach. I think it's just harder when you're not a good team.
Michael Tracos covers the Toronto Maple Leafs for the National Post newspaper. He's a frequent guest on this program. Michael, appreciate your time as always.
I love it, guys. Thanks very much.
Take care, Michael. Thanks very much.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Big thank you to Michael Tracos of the National Post for joining me earlier today to talk about Phil Kessel, talk about the Toronto Maple Leafs. In case you missed any of that, any of the show, any of the earlier interview with Frank Saravelli, it'll be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca. Get a sent to your iPod each and every week. Of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, today is Bell Let's Talk Day. Really a tremendous initiative by this station, this corporation, and really people all over throughout Canada and the world. It's a tremendous phenomenon for a tremendous cause. According to Let's Talk .bell.ca website, there have been over 99 million interactions using Bell Let's Talk. 99 million. That counts for about 3 for every person in this country. That's tremendous. That's absolutely tremendous for a good cause, for ending the stigma associated with mental health and with mental illness. And it's truly an honor to be able to be a part of such a good cause. The little bit that we do here, that I do, that we do through Illegal Curve, you know, certainly just a small cog in this machine. And we thank you and thank everybody listening for their help and their participation in this great initiative. Mike Babcock, head coach of the Detroit Red Wings, was on this program earlier today, paired with Darren Bombing, filling in on the Rona Roundtable. Here's part of what Mike Babcock had to say. He's on board with the Bell Let's Talk initiative.
Well, I think the first thing is, obviously, is you're looking for someone that's trustworthy and worthy of your trust. And who is that? Is that an aunt? Is that an uncle? Is that a guidance counselor? Is that a teacher? Is that your coach? But I think, you know, all walks of life, when you're around people constantly, we have 23 players on our team here in the National Hockey League. Things go ebbs and flows. And so when something's bothering someone, you can normally tell. Walk over and ask. Take the time to ask. And the usually common thing is, oh, everything's okay. No, what's wrong? What's really wrong? What's amazing when you get a conversation going, what comes out? I have to tell you, though, in the last 2 years since I got involved in this, I've learned a ton about how the language that you should use, how to ask people questions, how to be more sensitive when you're asking these questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm as hard a driver as there possibly is. Believe me, I expect you to do it right, and I expect you to do it right every day. But we all have things going on in our life. And it's not all mental health, but there's things that are bothering us. Having the opportunity and the platform to talk about it makes it much easier. When you share, when you talk about it, It's therapeutic. And to me, that's what this is about. It's letting people know that mental toughness and mental illness are totally different things, whether that be heart problems, whether that be blood pressure problems. Those things we don't hide. There's no sense hiding them.
That's Detroit Red Wings head coach Mike Babcock. We'll hear more from him coming up in a second. I want to give props to one of my colleagues with the Legal Curve. That's Dave Manuk. Don't often hear him on this station, but he does a lot of great work. He does all the work, really, for LegalCurve.com behind the scenes. You know, and he wrote a first-person piece regarding Bell Let's Talk Day today, and I'm going to share it with you. I'm sure Dave won't mind because he publicly posted it on the website anyways. I was thinking of the impact of these many tweets I've been reading this morning with the hashtag Bell Let's Talk, and I cannot help but think, while it is good that people consider the ramifications of mental health today, we really need to make a better effort of continuing this practice throughout the year. We all love hockey. It is the reason you read this site, LegalCurve.com, on a daily, hopefully hourly basis. But I sometimes cannot understand the level of vitriol with which folks talk to each other about this game. Whether someone understands the game at the most advanced level or is simply enjoying it for the love of the game, we all have opinions that we are entitled to. That doesn't mean that we cannot have healthy debate about our respective positions, but there is a way to do this in a respectful manner. I lost one of my best friends growing up to a mental health disorder, and once you've experienced that, it changes the way you think about this disease. You realize the impact it had on their life, the life of their family, as well as their friends. So when you are getting ready to send that caustic tweet, text, Facebook message, perhaps wait a few seconds, reread it, and think about the impact your comment will have on the person you are sending it to. Perhaps the hashtag for the rest of the year should be hashtag Let's Talk Nicely. Dave Manuk on IllegalCurve.com. We'll conclude this segment with a little bit more from Mike Babcock earlier today on the Rona Roundtable. Remember the hashtag, Bell Let's Talk. You can use it today. You can use it every day. People are always there to reach out and help you.
Well, there's a 100% true. And when you think about strength, personal strength, to me, talk about it, I think you're showing strength. The people that ask questions are showing confidence. They're looking for help. When you suffer by yourself, you're only hurting yourself. Well, actually, you're hurting everyone around you.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been put on this earth. God gave you a skill set. He expects you to maximize that. You can't do that suffering in silence. That makes no sense. You know, when you think about it, like I said to you, a team of 23 people, things are going on all the time. We all need help. I'm real fortunate. I have a great family. My family energizes me. I can talk to them. I was raised by a mother that allowed me to talk about everything. I just think it leads to having problems be way shorter when you get out and you talk about them.
The hashtag again is Bell Let's Talk. End the stigma surrounding mental health. People are there to help you. Friends, sometimes strangers. You're just a phone call, a tweet, a text, a helping hand is right there for you. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Shortly past 7:30 in the evening, Wednesday evening, NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel alongside Michael Remus in studio. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. This weekend at Rumors, Deborah DiGiovanni. It's a concert series event. Tickets sold out for both shows on Friday, the early show on Saturday. So what I'm saying is very few tickets remain. Be sure to get them at rumorscomedyclub.com. If you've never seen Deborah live and in person, you should get down to Rumors ASAP. Absolutely hilarious stuff. She's a tremendous comedian. Check her out, rumorscomedyclub.com, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. And there's an entire list of performers and showtimes there. Remo, it's been about 3-4 days now since the NHL officially announced the format for the upcoming 2016 World Cup of Hockey. We talked about it a bit on Saturday's show as the news broke right when we were there. You know, thought we'd look back at it, see if, you know, a sober second thought has taken effect. Maybe, you know, after you've slept on it, after you've thought about it, maybe it's, you know, I can live with that. Hey, that's not a bad idea after all, now that I really think about it. So, 3 days later, we're going to read you some quotes from some opinion makers throughout the country as well. 3 days later, any better for you?
I'll tell you what, I get the Europe All-Star team.
Yeah.
And I get what the NHL is trying to do. And I think when we criticize or talk about the World Cup, you need to look at it from the NHL's perspective. They're a business. They want to promote. They want to promote hockey, but they want to promote the NHL brand. And they want to make money for themselves. And this is going to become now a World Cup versus Olympics thing, because we all know the Olympics, they don't get any of the revenues. They don't have control of the schedule. It breaks up their season. World Cup, it's before the season. They can sell the TV rights. They can sell the tickets. And they get all the revenues. They want to showcase the NHL players. They don't really care about a Slovenia team that has one NHL player or a Denmark team that has three. That's why they're doing this, you know, and right now for the first year, they don't have time for it to do a qualifying tournament. So they say,
let me interrupt you right there.
Okay.
So the lack of the qualifying, I'm even tolerably okay with the European All-Stars.
Yes, I think that's an interesting idea.
Interesting is about as far as I'll go, and I'll grant you interesting. The under 23 All-Stars, here's the problem that I have with it. They're not committed to it. They admit themselves that it's only going to probably be a one-time thing.
Yes.
With this under 23 All-Stars. They say it's because they don't have enough time to do a proper qualifying tournament to get, you know, 8 full teams into the World Cup of Hockey. You can't create a tournament like the World Cup. If you want to be like the World Cup of Soccer, you know, they're calling it the World Cup of Hockey, so they want to be like the World Cup of Soccer.
Right.
You cannot put a team on there that's only going to be in there one time. Now, the under 23 team is a stupid idea. Don't have it at all. If you can't do it properly, don't do it at all. And I understand why they're doing it and why they're rushing it out when they themselves admit they're not ready to run it. It's because there's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. You know, they're envisioning $100 million of revenue. And they want that money. You cannot create a legacy tournament that people will remember for decades and for years upon years upon years. And then in one version of the tournament have the under 23 All-Stars and the, you know, team rest of Europe. And then the next year, the next version of the tournament, 4 years later, that team not exist. It just bastardizes the entire thing from the get-go. Everybody knows it's a cash grab. I have no problem with that, really. The NHL is all about the cash. But when you change the format and you change the teams that are in it, and 1 year there's the under 23 All-Stars and the next year there isn't, the whole thing is ridiculous. Part of the, the charm of the World Cup of Soccer is there's a qualifying event for it. So yes, the teams in it aren't the same every year, but you're never going to see the under 23 All-Stars from Brazil and Argentina join up to because they didn't have enough time to get enough teams in it. It's ridiculous. On its face, it's ridiculous. Here's Ed Willis in the Vancouver province. Ed Willis has written a tremendous book about the 1987 Canada Cup.
Yes, also about the CFL American expansion.
That too, but I mean, that's not really relevant. The 87 Fair. Canada Cup it's a great book. Check it out. I don't have the title in front of me. Google Ed Willis plus 87 Canada Cup. You can find it. You know, this is what he has to say. This event, of course, is already veering into the dangerous territory of self-parody, but the league doesn't see that. What it sees is a chance to control the revenue streams, the scheduling, the programming. There's already one report that they're envisioning $100 million in revenues, but isn't that the NHL? You know, I understand the NHL not wanting to go to South Korea for the Olympics. It's, you know, not going to be played in a convenient time to be watched here in Canada. The NHL has no players at the moment, as far as I know, from South Korea. So there's not the push to do it, and they don't get any of the revenue. You know, they don't get a, they get maybe a small pittance of the revenue, but it goes to the IIHF. I get that. So you know what? Don't go in 2016. Wait till 2018 then to unveil your World Cup. Give yourself the 4 years or the 3 years between now and 2018 to properly put together an international hockey tournament. And if you're going to run it every 4 years, run it in 2018 and run it in 2022. I don't know why it has to be in 2016. Why do you have to rush through a half-assed version of this tournament? Frankly, it could be a great tournament. If it's going to be your only real venture into the international, you know, best on best, country versus country type of hockey, don't rush it. Nothing is worse than when you rush it. It doesn't make any sense to cut your legs off just for the $100 million. I get why they do it, but it just, you know, takes away from the glitz and the glamour of the tournament to begin with. Sure, you don't think that FIFA, you know, their questionable business practices and all, don't think about running the World Cup every 2 years? Of course they do. They say, well, there's millions of hundreds of millions of dollars in it for us. Why wouldn't we do it? They don't because it waters down the product. So you're telling me that you're going to have the World Cup of Hockey in 2016. Maybe the NHL goes to the Olympics. NBC's broadcasting them, the Winter Olympics. They might put a lot of pressure on the NHL to go. None of us would be surprised if that was to happen. So was the NHL going to go to the Olympics as well in 2016? So you're going to play an Olympic tournament in 2016, World Cup of Hockey in 2016, and the World Hockey Championships in 2016? Where does it end? It's just too much relatively meaningless hockey. And I don't know why the NHL doesn't see that.
Yeah, I mean, they see it. Well, this is what they do say. They see the dollar signs. But when you do talk about best on best, Drew, I don't even know if the World Cup of Hockey would be best of best because the Team USA is going to be severely hampered by this under 23 rule.
Well, that's my point. Let me jump in there right there.
Okay.
Exactly. If it's not going to be best on best, if you're damaging the chances of the Team USA because some of their best players are under 23 years old, which could easily, by the way, happen to Canada at some point.
Yes.
You can't run the tournament. What's the point of having a sort of best against sort of best with this other weird mishmash of a team tournament? I mean, I know that you put anything in Toronto regarding hockey, and it's going to be an outstanding success. Because the business community and the corporate community in Toronto is too stupid to say, why am I paying good money to this really mediocre product? The NHL knows that, and they're going to just laugh all the way to the bank with it. But if you really want to create something that matters, if you really want to create something that means something, you can't play this tournament in 2016 under the current format that is proposed.
Well, it seems like, Drew, that's what's going to happen. And I wonder, and we had all these, you know, I compare this World Cup of Hockey to the World Baseball Classic because MLB created this tournament. And we heard some of the same criticisms before. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have all the best players. But when the tournament started and you had Team USA and you had Japan and you had Canada, I got behind it. I got behind Team Canada, the baseball. And I wonder if when the puck drops, it's going to be hockey on TV. It's going to be great television.
You're right.
Are people going to be tuned in?
Of course people will tune in.
Yes.
Of course people will tune in. And people are entitled to do what they want. I just think it's such nonsense and so patronizing of the NHL to trot this out as if it's something really special, when it's not. It's nothing really special. If Canada loses at the 2016 World Cup, really, do you care?
That's fair. I mean,
two years after they won in Sochi, the most dominant performance we've seen, really, by an international hockey team in decades. Team Canada didn't have a chance of losing in Sochi. They were that dominant. If they lose the 2016 World Cup, are you really going to care? I'm not. I didn't really, you know, it's just not exciting. It doesn't matter. I got my gold. Canada's got their gold medal. I woke up at 5 in the morning like everybody else to watch it. You lose the 2016, you know, World Cup of Hockey to whatever team because maybe some of your best players are under 23 years old. Are you really going to care? Is it going to make a splash in the United States, in the television market in the United States? when they're not really a full Team United States?
Yeah, that, I think that's the biggest concern. I mean, you look at guys like Jacob Trouba, Seth Jones, Jack Eichel could potentially be on that team. I don't know for sure. But when you have a Team Canada that's going to be probably very stacked, and then Team USA not going to be able to field their best team because of this idiotic rule that you have to be, if you're 23, you're only eligible for the under-23 team. I think that certainly does something away. And what I gather from you, Drew, is you're saying, look, NHL, hey, I get this. You want our money. This is a cap drag. But just don't make it so damn obvious.
No, I don't even care if they make it obvious. You know, I understand that business is first and foremost the only thing. I get that. Just give enough time between these events.
Yeah.
Don't have an event every year, because if you have, you know, if everything is available and it's always available, then everything means nothing. If you have an international tournament every year,
yeah,
none of them ever mean anything. So give it the 4 years to breathe. Wait till 2018. Do your proper qualifying tournament. Let's see Team Germany, led by Leon Draisaitl, play against Team Denmark, led by Nikolai Ehlers, for a chance to make it to qualify for the tournament. Let's get German national pride and Denmark national pride flying. Tune in Europe. Don't give me this mishmash garbage just because you need to rush out another international tournament.
Okay, let's get to the next crazy idea they have. This, what is it, the Ryder Cup of hockey?
I don't understand what this is at all.
And what was that, some September in London, get the best North American skaters to form a team, get the best European skaters to form a team, and play, what, a three-game set?
Something like that, or a best out of five. Again, that's very sketchy in terms of the details. It sounds like they're going to... I'm not sure how that's a Ryder Cup style. That's just a tournament of the best from North America against the best from Europe. That's not a Ryder. Somebody needs to go look at what the Ryder Cup was and what the Ryder Cup is in terms of a golf tournament. And that's how a golf and that's what the Ryder Cup is. This is just a tournament.
Well, Drew,
or a matchup.
What I learned from the NHL is they're not so good with terminology. They were calling it on last Friday the NHL All-Star Fantasy Draft. There was no fantasy involved. That they were actually playing a game. It was just a draft.
Fair enough. I agree with that statement,
too. So the NHL, when it comes to technical terminology, not very good.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. But, you know, that I could even see maybe having a little bit of merit.
I actually don't mind it, but I you're putting through these top players through a lot. And are they going to care when they play? And if someone gets hurt, you're going to have some owner raising a huge stink.
Sure, of course. But at least this point in time, if they do these events, the money goes to the NHL.
Right.
It doesn't go to the IIHF. So, you know, at least if, you know, who got injured? John Tavares got injured in Sochi. If he gets injured in the, quote, Ryder Cup event in London that's rumored for, I don't even know what year, 2018. If he gets injured there, at least the money goes to the owner of the Islanders in the meantime, not going to the IIHF. So I wouldn't mind seeing Team North America against Team Europe. I can do without it, though. But that maybe has a little bit of interest.
It's kind of intriguing. I mean, but I do agree. World Cup, I'm probably going to watch it. I'm going to look forward to it. But at the same time, it's going to have this cloud over that saying, hey, you know, some of these teams weren't able to field their best. And what do you think about – and we haven't even talked about what the potential jerseys for Team Europe and Team Under-23. And what if one of those teams win? What anthem are they going to play? Are they going to have, like, Slash come out and write some hip song?
Why did you pick Slash?
I don't know.
Why is Slash writing the national anthem for Team Europe? That doesn't make any sense.
He would be under, I don't know.
I mean, maybe
Justin Bieber under 23. He's under 23, isn't he?
I don't know, but and I'm sad.
Who do you want some Europe person?
No, I think
Wham.
Maybe the winner of Eurovision gets to write the national anthem for Team Rest of Europe.
Are they gonna have an American Idol style contest to see who gets to make the jerseys and the anthem?
Do you not know what Eurovision is?
I have no idea.
Eurovision is a European song competition that happens every year, it's very much the participants are grouped by country. Like, there's playdowns in countries, and I think each of the participants represents a different country.
Holy.
And then there's a big winner. It's
huge. How do you know what that is?
I'm very worldly. What can I tell you? Let's go to break.
I don't know. Okay.
That's enough. Let's go to break.
You got worked up there, Drew. I like it.
Okay. I was filling the role of Richie Pollock.
It was good.
Thank you.
We need more of that.
You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
10 minutes before the top of the hour, you're listening to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. Reminder, 12 noon, Saturday. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show on this fine station. We'll start off coverage, previewing the Jets and the Stars later on that evening at MTS Center. The Jets return home for their, they got, I guess, one game sandwiched in between four road games. Obviously lost last night in Pittsburgh, play tomorrow night in Philly. Game you can hear 6 p.m. Central Time on TSN 1290. Saturday, they're home to Dallas, and then they head out to Vancouver and Calgary. I guess Calgary and then Vancouver, to be perfectly exact. Monday, Tuesday for a back-to-back. Before then, they're home, I think, again, for a couple of games. I guess that Friday, December 6th game against the Blackhawks, the return of Daniel Carcillo.
Yes. Looking forward to the crowd reception that he's going to. I think he'll get booed mercilessly, and I'm looking forward to watching that.
He'll have to answer the bell at least once. I suspect that Anthony Peluso is...
Really? Because they're not in the same weight class, and he doesn't fight people above his weight class, Carcillo. I think he's going to shy away.
Well, I mean, I'd say that the code would say that he has to fight.
Yeah,
he doesn't abide by the code to begin with.
He plays by his own code.
That's right. He's got his own code, so I suppose the code doesn't really matter in this case. But that's assuming, of course, that he's even going to be in the Blackhawks lineup.
Also true. I wonder if they'll leave him out just, you know, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So you don't have to go through that whole thing.
Yeah.
Or maybe Joel Quenneville will be like, yeah, let's throw this guy in there. He dug his own grave.
That's true. I mean, at some point in time, you do have to make the bed that you slept in or whatever.
Or sleep the bed that you make.
No, I don't think that's it either. Make the bed that you... forget it. Anyways, tweet just from now, the St. Louis Blues. Okay. Legendary Blues goaltender, Martin Brodeur, will drop the puck before tomorrow's 7 p.m. game versus Nashville. I may have added in the legendary Blues goaltender part.
The Blues didn't write legendary.
They did not. I added that in because a little editorial license, if you will. But Marty Brodeur officially announced his retirement as we expected he would. Plays the few games in a St. Louis Blues jersey. You know, did an adequate job, I suppose, as a Blues goaltender. Here's some audio. Here's Jamie McLennan on Marty Brodeur retiring as a St. Louis Blue.
Yeah, it is a little bit weird, you know, but we do see now, even as far back as Ray Bourque trying to win that last Stanley Cup and move on to other organizations. Obviously, we've seen, you know, again, different ages, but a guy like Jerome McGinley move on from Calgary to try and, you know, win. It ended up Pittsburgh, Boston, now Colorado. You know, every person I've ever talked to, and I can lump myself in there, is you play as long as you can play. And I think Marty Brodeur had some personal goals that he was trying to get to 700 wins. And, you know, it's tough because I take a look back at Marty Brodeur's career, and I don't just remember like this year kicking around and trying to get to 700 with the St. Louis Blues. We remember the heydays, him scoring goals, him, you know, winning cups and Vezina trophies. I mean, you know, whether your favorite goaltender is Patrick Waugh, Dominic Hasek, Marty Brodeur, you have to include him in the conversation of the greatest of all time.
Let me ask you, Remo. You met Jamie McLennan there talking about Brodeur in the conversation as greatest of all time.
Yes.
Does he win in your books? Is he the winner of that barroom argument that'll never have a legitimate winner?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think Terry Sawchuk, I think, always has to be there if you want to go back a ways. But in terms of recent goals.
Modern, let's say since the 1980s.
Right.
Since 85.
I would say him or Patrick Waugh or Dominic Hasek. I think those are the
Thank
the
you.
Big
I know three. That it's between those three, but thanks for going out on a limb there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really, do you have an opinion?
Sure. I mean, he's got the most wins. He's got the cups. He played for a long time. I could say, sure, let's go with him. Ed Brodeur is the best.
You know, I'm pretty sure that when I asked that question, I could have said any player's name there and you would have agreed with me. Before we wrap up the show, let's play another clip from Marty Brodeur's great career. How about him scoring a goal versus Montreal?
Empty net. Canadians have the extra attacker. They need two. Brodeur looking for the goal. Down the ice. Scored by Ted Brodeur.
You know what? He was a fantastic puck handler, so I think,
yes.
and revolutionary, I think, in his puck handling skills, in the manner in which he was able to do it. So I think it's only fitting that we end tonight's show with Marty Brodeur scoring a goal, the end of a fantastic, legendary, undoubtedly, next stop, the Hockey Hall of Fame for Marty Brodeur, New Jersey Devils goaltender, St. Louis Blues goaltender.
For sure. And before we wrap it up, I think we should give a Marty Brodeur memory. And I'm going to throw in 2002 Olympics.
Yeah.
A fan of Team Canada. They started Curtis Joseph the first two games, rightfully so at the time. I mean, he was Pat Quinn's guy. So there was a bit of conflict of interest. Things didn't go so well. You remember Gretzky coming out with a speech. They throw in Marty Brodeur, and the rest is history.
Absolutely, leading Canada to their first gold medal in, I think it was about 412 years, if I'm not mistaken. That's it for this Wednesday evening and NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to our guests, Frank Saravelli from the Philadelphia Daily News and Michael Trakos from the National Post. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and on our website, illegalcurve.com. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, and Bernstein's Deli. Follow us on Twitter, at IllegalCurve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. For Michael Remus, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Remember, hashtag Bell Let's Talk, and until Saturday at 12 noon, we wish you good night and good luck.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.